Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 204 for comics originally released on July 6th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is Flashpoint Secret 7 number 2. Now, this title has kind of a interesting mix of kind of the magical and Vertigo-ish kinds of characters. We got Amethyst, we got Zatanna, we got Tracy 13, a bunch of those kinds of characters. And this isn't really the kind of thing sometimes that I go out of my way looking for, but by and large, this was a really good read. There was a lot of story in this issue with a lot of information about pretty much, I think, all of the members of the team and kind of their status quo and, you know, where things are at, both in the Flashpoint world in general and for these characters in specific. And frankly, I thought this issue was a lot more informative than that first issue was.
I would agree with that. I kind of didn't take that strongly to the first issue, and I didn't dig it out of the box and compare it side by side to this one, but I came away from the first issue kind of thinking it was a little more shade Vertigo-ish than this one. And less accessible as a result, because I didn't really read and I wasn't a fan of the Shade Vertigo series. I read a couple of issues enough to know it wasn't my cup of tea. But this one seemed a lot more accessible and I enjoyed it a lot more. Now, that said, on the solicit information, I know that the first issue of this was solicited as George Perez on the art, and he only actually did part of that issue, and he wasn't on this one at all. Was the solicit for number two, did that have any Perez claims in it?
Actually, you caught me on the 1 week I didn't have time to go dig that stuff up, so off the top of my head, I'm not sure. But I do think they have swapped out a couple of art teams and stuff on a few of these issues, or a few of these titles on the second issue and stuff. But I do recall him being listed on the first, but I'd have to go look up this one.
I didn't mind the art that was in here. It was perfectly fine. It's just, I remember being really excited about this series initially because of the George Perez, claim, I guess we'll say.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they set expectations with that. I mean, he's a legendary artist, and as good as the art is in here, and you're right, it's good, but it's not George Perez, you know? It's, it is what it is on that. Now, I also didn't read that Shade the Changing Man series back when it came out in the early 90s, early to mid-90s. And I did a little research on that, because, I mean, this is written by Peter Milligan, who wrote all 70 of those issues. And, I mean, 70 is really a pretty long run by today's standards, both for a series and also for a writer. So I could definitely see where Milligan was, you know, leveraging Shade the Changing Man quite a bit, but, you know, he's one of those few and far between areas of the DC universe that just doesn't really, you know, kind of click with me and stuff. And, you know, as I was reading this, it's like, well, do I want to go pick up some of those back issues? Wow, there are 70 of them. Do I like it enough? You know, kind of a back and forth kind of a thing there. Now, one of the other characters we got here, which I fondly remember from back in the day, is Amethyst. So it was cool seeing her, or at least her alter ego of, Amy, I forget her last name, Amy Winston. I'm hoping we actually get to see her as Amethyst soon. Which actually would, I guess, be in the next issue or not at all. This was one that this title seems to be kind of setting the stage for what the dark group of titles in the DC 2.0 lineup might be like, because it's got similar-ish kinds of characters and a bent to it. And it kind of has me questioning how many of those titles I'm going to be getting. Because as good as this is, you know, I'm fine with it for a miniseries, but it's getting a little more into kind of, well, the dark, I guess, than, you know, I tend to gravitate towards in general. I mean, I never really got a lot of Vertigo titles.
And that's okay, you know, because they're trying to make different parts of DC appeal to different demographics, I think.
Exactly.
You know, so I would almost be disappointed if any one person was in love with everything that they're doing in DC 2.0, because that would mean that, well, I guess I could mean it, you know, you got like a person who is like really open-minded and loves just everything, but otherwise it just means that a lot of it's kind of homogenizing down to you know, being, you know, commonly appealing, as opposed to, you know, getting a little crisper and focusing in on kind of different core audiences and, you know, getting some kind of comics that those people would really love. And I think that's fine. I think that ultimately it'll serve them well to appeal to different groups of readers.
I agree with that entirely. I think it's a good thing for them to be, like you said, diversifying both their fan base and their material, getting to different genres. I mean, I can remember back in the day when DC would be coming out with everything from Sugar and Spike of, you know, little baby kids, you know, adventure type stories or whatever, to, you know, the Sergeant Rock stuff with war stuff, to, you know, sci-fi, to superheroes, to, I mean, you name it, they covered the whole basis. And really, I think over the intervening decades, a lot of it had gotten down to pretty much just kind of the, I don't say the run-of-the-mill superhero, but you know what I mean, more narrow focused there. So the fact they're branching out, I think, is good. The potential risk of that is, I mean, right now I'm one of these guys who's by and large getting just about everything in the DC universe, aside from like Jonah Hex and maybe one or two other titles. And if that starts getting to where it's like, well, I mean, those aren't contemporary titles, so it's okay, I'm getting the main current DC universe. If that starts to change, then it opens the door to, well, if I'm not getting two titles, I don't need to get the third. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a double-edged sword. I think they need to diversify, and they need to make sure that all of the books that are something that would click with particular members of the audience, they're aware of and they stick with.
But most people are not going to get all of the books anyway, even in a certain family. I mean, the Batman books, for instance, you know, there were 11 of them in the first wave. And then it's starting to hit the web now, the October solicits, and there's two additional books in the Batman family. So that'll bring it up to 13. You know, even someone who loves Batman and all the different Batman-y kind of characters, you know, I don't know if they want to get 13 different Batman books, you know. Or,
well, it's
they're
like
not
three
all,
a
they're
week.
Not all Batman, you know, because some, but, you know, you got Batwing and you got The Huntress is a new one that's, you know, coming in October. And, you know, I think Birds of Prey is in the Batman family of titles.
Yeah.
So they're Gotham kind of titles. But even so, I mean, that's a lot of books. And, you know, some people are going to like this subset, you know, and another group is going to like a different subset. And, you know, hopefully everyone will like kind of the core title, like Batman, for instance. And then they'll pick and choose some of the other ones. And, you know, there will be people who like them all and get them all. But, you know, you have a broad enough base of choices for people that there should be something for everybody so that anybody can find at least a couple of books that holds their interest.
Well, because that gives them a toehold or foothold into the DC universe from which they can expand and try to get that reader into other stuff. And you're right, when we've looked at the sales figures on stories that cross titles and stuff, in a lot of cases we'll see whatever that tentpole series is in a family of books, be it Batman or, you know, Green Lantern or, you know, whichever one in whichever group, and then the others, you know, some doing, you know, 80% of those sales, some doing half those sales, whatever. So you're right, not everyone's getting everything, but I am really curious and have no way of gauging how many people are kind of at that end of the spectrum where I'm at of getting most of that stuff and how many are not.
Right.
And if they start to chip away at that upper end, will that have negative ramifications or not? And if they're telling good stories across the board, it shouldn't. Because if I don't go for all the dark books, there are going to be other people who have been skipping a lot of DC books that'll go after that.
Well, you know, they might be able to get some of the people who maybe right now only buy Vertigo books.
Yeah.
To jump over and, you know, because there's still going to be Vertigo books, as far as we know, you know, for a while. And, well, you know,
I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Vertigo going forward, because they're taking a lot of things that had been Vertigo, very clearly Vertigo titles, and merging them in, yet other things are staying there very clearly.
Right. Well, I think that what they're doing, and I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, is they're taking the Vertigo titles that had a relationship to and kind of came from the DC universe, and they're merging them back into the DC universe in the dark area. You know, you have your, you know, Swamp Thing, and, you know, your, you know, those kinds of books, John Constantine, you know, and, but then your Holy Vertigo books, you know, your American Vampire and Fables and, you know, Scalped, Northlanders, Sweet Tooth, and these things that are kind of creator owned, completely separate from the DCU creative vision kind of things. And in the past, you know, like Why the Last Man and
Ex Machina,
100 Bullets. Ex Machina was Wildstorm, but it would have fit in Vertigo, right? So I think that's not a bad thing to take, and I have no idea if this is what they're going to do, right? But I mean, it could be the case that they just take Vertigo and keep it being those comics that are completely separate things, and they're more of the mature titles, you know, and that's Vertigo. And then the things that have characters that are DC characters, Zatanna, Shade, Swamp Thing, etc., you know, keep those in the DC dark corner of the DC universe. Now, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that too. And even if they want to take somebody like Constantine and have him both in the DC universe and kind of a maybe a different version or the same or whatever over in Hellblazer and Vertigo, hell, I'm fine with that too. I mean, if they want to do that, that's cool. I think it's going to be very interesting moving forward to see how DC does on their branding, on how they kind of position what's in the DC universe, what's in Vertigo. Is there a clear, okay, here's a new title? Well, instinctively, we would all think it would fit in one side or the other, and that's, of course, where it lands. Because there have been some times in the past where, particularly when Johnny DC was a little bit in flux, there were some titles that landed there that maybe shouldn't have, and, you know, a few that landed in the DC Universe section of previews, like The Mighty, that clearly weren't part of the DC Universe. So they've got an opportunity here to reassess how they do some of those dividing lines, how they do some of that branding. And it's going to be interesting because they've been referring to this whole new lineup as kind of the new 52. Well, in October, you said they're getting at least three new Batman titles?
Two new Batman titles that they've announced. Penguin, well, they're both miniseries. So there's a Penguin miniseries and a Huntress miniseries.
Okay.
The Huntress miniseries looks really interesting because Paul Levitz is going to write it. And, you know, Paul Levitz, he wrote
the originated
first
character.
The origin of the Helena Wayne Huntress back in DC Superstar 17, and then in the All-Star Comics where she joined the JSA. So it'll be kind of cool to see what he does, because this is going to be a Helena Bertinelli, you know, with the Italian and all that kind of stuff, you know, version of the character. But he's going to be writing it, and he's a great writer, so I'm very interested. The other one's a Penguin miniseries, which I'm not so sure that was a good one to go with, but we'll see how, you know, that early in the relaunch, but we'll see how that goes. And then over in the DC Dark, they've also talked about a Shade miniseries by James Robinson with Cully Hamner on the art. So those are the ones that, you know, and as we record this, and we're recording early, you know, they're doing some announcements of different things, and I'm sure at the San Diego Con, there'll be even more of these announcements of things that are up and coming.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, San Diego's always a huge news week for comics. It's actually very hard to keep track of all the announcements that happen during that week.
Right. But it's actually interesting and kind of smart when you think about it, because the new 52, I mean, those are all ongoing series so far, right, until something gets canceled. But you know, the new ones so far that they've announced are all explicitly miniseries. So technically, there still are 52 ongoing series. And if they make the other things miniseries, it doesn't mess with the purity of that marketing message.
I'm just saying they could have gone with a simpler, you know, like a DC 2.0 kind of a lineup and not done that. Because sooner or later, they're going to say, hey, we're going to add or shift the titles, number of titles and stuff. And that's cool. But it's going to be interesting, again, to see how they kind of try to position things moving forward. Now, for Flashpoint, overall, I thought it, the Secret Seven stuff was really good. I'm actually enjoying a lot of the other Flashpoint stuff quite a bit, too. For me, this was a very clear 4 out of 5. Again, the subject and kind of tone and style of the story, again, a little darker than I tend to care for, but again, very well done. And I could see how Peter Milligan was able to keep the Shade series going for 70 issues, no problem.
Yeah, I give it a 4 also, and I was very impressed. I'm glad you wanted to review this one this week, because I had originally not gone with this title. It was the only one of the Flashpoint ones that, based on the first issue, I wasn't planning on getting the second issue, and I'm glad I did, because I like the second issue a lot more than I like the first issue.
Cool.
Okay, moving over to Marvel. We've got a miniseries, Red Skull Incarnate. It is the, I guess, origin story of the Red Skull. I think we've seen some kind of origin stories of the Red Skull previously. This is a different take on it, since we're starting with him as a young boy in Munich in 1923. This is kind of after the Germans lost World War One, and there's kind of hard times in Germany, and we can see, you know, how the National Socialist Party was getting its toehold in the country. It's kind of, I had a mixed feelings on the story, you know, kind of like from a historical perspective. I mean, it seemed, you know, I'm not like a scholar of such things, but it seemed relatively accurate to the time. It had, you know, some interesting human element to it. And, you know, you see that the Red Skull's, you know, an orphan, he's in this orphanage, kind of, you know, and abused by the, you know, stereotypical evil SOB that runs the orphanages. Like, is there an orphanage anywhere that's ever not had some total jerk running it? You know, it seems to be a staple of fiction to have these evil characters running orphanages.
It does seem to be somewhat cliche. I mean, there wouldn't be much of a story if the kids just loved being in the orphanage.
Well, that's true.
Refused to leave. Well, that could be fun too.
We never have the There's no good story element to the orphanages that are around that have nice people running them.
Well, actually, there is. I mean, they could do something where the kids all want to run away to the orphanage, so they have to kill their parents or something. I mean, yeah, it'd be kind of a disturbed story, but it would be possible.
There you go. Anyway, I mean, you know, so I was reading this, and on one hand, I thought it was a very well-told story. On the other hand, you know, it was just a little dark and, you know, a little in the overall arc of this, I can see where it's necessary. I mean, it was all set up, though, right? He's like a little kid, and he's meeting, you know, someone who's...
I don't know that I would say that it was all set up, because I think we got a clear bit of character arc just within this one issue. You know, from where the character was at the beginning to where he is at the end. Obviously, there's a lot more to come, you know, but I think we got enough payoff here to not categorize it all as setup. But I guess it's
how you define setup. I mean, as far as, you know, I'm looking at it as, you know, there's no Red Skull in the issue at all.
He's not even
close to becoming Red Skull yet. And, you know, in previous ones, they're much more abbreviated, right? You've got a few panels of, you know, establishing, you know,
he was a boy, then he was the
a
Red Skull
boy, and Hitler sees him and says, hey, I'm gonna make you evil now, you know. And, you know, it's, you kind of get right into it. And this, I think that it's a much more in-depth and complete exploration of what goes into making someone the Red Skull. But I wouldn't be surprised if you don't see actual Red Skull until issue 3 or maybe even 4.
I could see it being 4 or 5, yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, for me, I thought this was an effectively told story, both in terms of the story and the art, and that was both a plus and a minus. Plus, because, I mean, it's a very well-done story. The minus in so much is it's a very well done story about a guy becoming essentially the evil monster known as the Red Skull eventually. So again, like you said, kind of dark, kind of not so, you know, uplifting or whatever. But anytime you try to focus a miniseries or a story or whatever on a villain, particularly one such as the Red Skull, one of the premier villains of the Marvel Universe, I mean, that's kind of a difficult task because, you know, by definition, the lead character's not really going to be a likable, warm, fuzzy kind of a guy. And in this case, you know, we get young Johann Schmidt, who's clearly hardened, you know, by the really horrific conditions he's in. And, you know, I think within just this one issue, it's clear how he's already made kind of that first turn towards eventually becoming the Red Skull. And you're right, this is set up in so much as it's going to be a little ways before we get to the Red Skull, but I think we had enough of a character arc in here, just within these pages, from where he started to where he got, that I felt we got payoff on some of this. Whereas, when I would categorize an issue as all set up, we only get set up, but we don't get anything in terms of payoff.
Yeah, I can see that. I
can see where you're coming from, too, though.
You know, I think that what you want to go into this with the expectation of is this is a five-issue miniseries, and it's setting up the Red Skull, and you're probably not going to see the Red Skull until much later on in the series. You know, I think that it's something that will read well in trade, ultimately, you know, because you're going to be able to get to, if you want to see the Red Skull, if you go into this and you kind of really like the, you know, kind of psychological character study of, you know, what turns someone into this really evil villain, then I think you're going to, you know, get those individual arcs that give you those building blocks in each issue as it goes along.
Yeah.
But you're not going to probably get Red Skull, you know, until much later on.
Well, I mean, this series reminds me a lot of the Magneto Testament miniseries from a few years back, which was another very powerful story set around the same kind of time frame. You know, both examine kind of Germany around the time of World War II and the Nazis and stuff, which, of course, is a joyous time, not... Now, in this case, like you said, the story starts out, you know, a couple of years before the Nazis rise to power and stuff, but... You know, I think what you've kind of alluded to here, and I'll just flat out state, is really the strength of the story here is in kind of how the realism of the way the characters act and how they make really kind of understandable, if certainly not ideal, choices given the circumstances and the just where they're at. And it makes the story all the more disturbing because it becomes fairly plausible how, you know, a kid, I mean, the nobody is born inherently evil or whatever, yet you look at some of these major villains in the Marvel Universe, and clearly, well, they got that way somehow. So we're seeing how this young boy is starting to get corrupted, essentially, by the harshness of you know, the time and place he's living in. And, again, turning him towards, you know, the person who will eventually become the Red Skull. And, again, the Magneto Testament miniseries was another one of those that it was a very... I don't want to say cerebral, but a very, you know, character-driven, in a dark way, kind of a story. It was very powerful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it does flesh out and make the villain, who are many cases, you know, especially the old-timey, any of the old-timey characters, I mean, relatively two-dimensional, because they didn't have as many pages. You know, you look at Spider-Man, for instance, or the Fantastic Four. I mean, they were in all issue, every issue of this series, you know, for years. And there was time to kind of develop some dimensionality to their character. Whereas these bad guys, they show up every now and again, and they're mostly doing their evil plot, you know, and the setup for them is relatively two-dimensional. You know, well, as I recall from the original Red Skull origin, he's a bellhop, and Hitler decided he can turn anybody into an evil, you know, Nazi guy. And so he goes, even this bellboy, and he, like, takes him and he trains him to be this evil guy. And that was about all the justification you needed, you know, for it. And this seems like it's going to be much more, you know, giving a kind of life history of, you know, how you could get to that point.
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot more of the psychological element to this story, I think, much like we got in the Magneto Testament stuff. So if you're looking for something that's a little bit deeper and a bit different than your average, you know, hey, he was a bellhop, now he's a supervillain, kind of, you know, again, old style origin and stuff, this is going to be a good story to get, I think. Now, that having been said, I'm sure there's going to be many unpleasant aspects of the story, too, just by the nature of it. I found that with, again, Magneto Testament. So, again, well, both a pro and a minus, you know?
Yeah, there's already been unpleasant elements to the story in the first issue, so...
But you couldn't tell the origin of some of these characters without that. So it's not gratuitous is the part that gets me. It's
sure.
It's disturbing in, I don't want to say a good way, but in an understandable way. I mean, for me, this was very solidly a 4 out of 5. Very well told. I'm in for a miniseries, but man, I don't think I could read this type of a story or whatever on an ongoing basis.
And I agree. I gave it the same rating. And it's not, that's generally why series focusing on bad guys don't stick around for very long. You know, it's a very fine line to, be able to tread that, and you end up having to have somebody in a book for the reader to identify with. And hopefully, you know, people aren't going to be, you know, maybe when he's a little kid and you say, oh, it's too bad that this happened to him. But pretty quickly, I'm hoping there's not going to be a lot of people identifying with the Red Skull, you know.
Yeah, hopefully when he gets to the whole genocide stage or whatever, people aren't saying, yeah, go, you know, it's like, no, that'd be bad.
So, you know, it is a well-told story, and, I'm 100% sure that it's going to be a trade paperback almost instantaneously upon the series being completed, so, that would be a fine way to read the series also. Our last book of the week image is 50 Girls 50. Now, this series, it's written by Doug Murray and Frank Cho. And I think Frank Cho, maybe he did some of the character designs and has, he's providing the covers to the series.
He's also a co-creator.
Yeah. I mean, he's a co-writer and co-creator of the series. And the premise of this series is you have these spaceships that are staffed completely by women. I forget what the rationale was that they gave in the. I think
something
it was,
to do with the Y chromosome or something that.
It was something like women, when they go through these space warps or something, you know, they handle it better than men. And, you know, so they have to have all female crews. And, you know, it's kind of a, Deep Space Nine kind of Lost kind of thing where, you know, something goes awry and they're trying to get back to Earth and they have like some vital supplies. And, you know, so they've been seemingly in the first and second issues going through some relatively disjointed adventures as they pop out of the space warp and there's a planet there and they have an adventure on that planet, kind of like an episode of Star Trek, you know, in that, you know, usually, you know, you have the basic premise, but then the meat of the episode is interacting with, you know, some other group or other situation that goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say 50 Girls 50 is pretty much what you'd probably expect from a Frank Cho science fiction story. A lot of women, kind of that standard sci-fi television kind of, you know, setting, like you said, kind of Star Trek-ish, but not exactly, you know. Again, you've got elements from a ton of different, you know, primetime live-action sci-fi elements, because, I mean, it's the staple of the genre. You get a lot of action, get quite a few explosions, and it's...
They managed to have some girl shower at least once an issue so far.
Again, that's the Frank Cho part. I'm okay with that. He's good at it. I mean, and the artist they've got, Axel Medellin, whatever, has a style evocative enough of Frank Cho that it fits. You know, and I'm not going to say this is the most innovative concept, but it's executed really well. You know, and I think the execution is more important than having something we've just never, ever seen before. Because you're right. There's aspects of this that are similar enough to kind of the Star Trek or Stargate. Hey, there's a planet. Let's go see what happens. Wackiness ensues. You know, but it's a time-honored technique because it can make for some good stories. I appreciated how they kept the focus on just a handful of characters, making it a lot easier to keep track of kind of who's who. There was a clear plot line here, and again, it read kind of like a good hour-long sci-fi television episode in all of the right ways. The thing that got me is I think there's clearly a lot more story here than we're being told, and that's both kind of good and bad. Good, because it's clear that it's not just a surface story. There's backstory being hinted at, things being alluded to, and kind of there's, again, another layer here. But bad in so much as this is the second issue of a 4-issue miniseries, and this concept and the things they're hinting at are clearly larger than that. And, I mean, the text piece, I think, in the first issue indicated there's probably going to be a future miniseries, but it makes me wonder if they're hinting at more than we're going to see anytime soon.
I mean, for me, I like the idea of the miniseries more than I like the execution of these issues.
Really?
For me, visiting the planet and having the, kind of adventure with the weird aliens, it's not resonating with me that well. You know, it's like, you know, they even comment in the issue, you know, it's like, boy, you know, how do we keep, you know, having this many problems on going on these away missions? You know, it's like they go horribly awry and, you know, they end up doing this. I don't want to ruin the issue, but, you know, it's like, well, okay.
I took that line as one of those things I was just talking about where there's more to the story than we're being told, because they're realizing that, hey, we're supposed to be the best of the best in this spaceship and stuff that Earth had to offer, and things aren't going so well. We're doing things wrong, we're having bad luck, you know, whatever kind of a this can't be natural, but not really aware of that quite yet, if you know what I mean. So I saw that as a foreshadowing of more story elements to come.
Oh yeah, and I can see that. And if it was an ongoing series, I would kind of give them that. And even though it's going to be maybe a series of miniseries, you know, when I get 2 issues into a 4-issue miniseries, and it just seems like they've done a couple of disjointed, Planetfall kind of things, I'm kind of looking for where's the meat to some extent. And it's not bad, but for me, I gave it a 3 out of 5. I mean, it was an okay story. I liked it. It didn't really rise above that for me.
I can see that. I guess for me, there were a lot of things that are kind of, again, the expected stuff. Gee, you got the spaceship, you've got the away mission, you know, all of the standard, again, TV sci-fi cliches or genre elements, which, you know, frankly, I really like. You know, are they doing it particularly brilliantly here? No, but they're doing it very well, very fun. So that, to me, gave it a very solid footing. The fact that I think there's stuff being hinted at of there could be more to what's going on here, I like. But, you know, I agree with you. If this was an ongoing, it would give it more of a positive there. Because right now I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get all this other story. But the question is, well, when and where?
Yeah, and, you know, that's it. I mean, I see the end of the miniseries kind of like charging up, and, you know, are they going to kind of just leave you hanging at the end of it? You know, it's like we do 2 more random Planetfall kind of issues, and how are they going to wrap up the series? Could be good, you know. As an issue, you know, it was okay. It was fine. And I think, you know, the cheesecake factor was a little less gratuitous in this issue than in the first issue. Where they go down to the
not be.
Well, yeah, the first issue, they go down to this planet with a atmosphere that manages to dissolve the women's clothing, but, you know, doesn't cause any harm to their, you know, flawless skin. So, that was a little,
Yeah. Hey, personally, I really enjoyed this. I hope this property does return quickly after this miniseries ends. Now, if they want to take a little time just to make sure they can be on schedule and stuff, I'm cool with that. But I'd like to see more of this. It's a fun read. I like this kind of space fiction. Frankly, we're not getting a whole lot of it on television these days. And we normally don't get a whole lot of it in comics to begin with. So, you know, I enjoyed this. For me, it was a 4 out of 5. I can see where you're coming from on your rating, and have no issue with that. I liked the text piece at the end about the tech of the series. It was informative, and served to enhance the story while not being kind of required reading to understand the story. So it was a nice kind of bonus material.
I had one big issue with the text piece, and that is, you know, there's two kinds of science fiction. Well, there's many kinds. There's the two I'm going to talk about right now are you have science fiction where they don't really get into a lot of details on the tech. It just kind of happens. Or, you know, they get into the tech and they try to give explanations for how the tech works. Now, in many cases, like Star Trek, you know, like as an example, Star Wars, right? They don't really talk in very much detail about how any of the tech in Star Wars works, right? It's just kind of in the movies, you know.
In
maybe
the first
there's
set
some,
of movies, they get yeah. a little into that at the second, at their detriment. So I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's
but they
it's
don't
a science
like go
fiction
into
setting,
right?
It's not a science class,
right? They don't go into details. Now Star Trek, on the other hand, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, oh, let's have the dilithium crystals and isolinear chip this, and you know, and they make up a bunch of stuff so that they don't have to be completely accurate, right? On, because you know, it's like, how do you know how an isolinear chip is going to work, you know, and you know, these kind of things. Now in this one, they kind of straddle that boundary, and you know, they're saying, oh, the ships of the best tech that's available, tech beyond what we have today, tech that might seem almost magical because it's so advanced. But then they say the ship is powered by a fusion reactor that breaks water into its component molecules. Well, first off, water's a molecule. It breaks water into its component atoms, right? hydrogen and oxygen. And when you break something down, it's fission, not fusion. And I'm sorry, I had chemistry in high school 20 years ago. And, you know, it's like when you're going to do something and not just use made-up stuff, I'm like, am I remembering my high school chemistry class right? It's been a long time. It took me 30 seconds on Google to like come up with, well, this is just wrong. We could have rewritten this, you know, to not have it be, you know, even with magic future tech, it's just wrong. And yeah, it didn't need to be.
It violates the known science of today. And the fact that between Google and Wikipedia, it is trivial to go fact check this or whatever is unfortunate. And, you know, you're right. That's something that a lot of these shows on television that are of this ilk have to their advantage. Because like you said, Star Trek, they make it up. As long as they're consistent within what they have established, they're good. You get something like Doctor Who, and man, it's fairly freewheeling on that, but it's about the adventure, not about the science.
Right.
Here, at least in the story, they're mainly about the adventure. But you're right. When they do a tech piece on the tech of it, they're veering into, because they're trying to explain how all this works. That's clearly the technobabble section, and that does bring in that level of, well, wait a sec, guys, you're just wrong on this. Which is, you know, to me, I wasn't really fazed by that, but again, it wouldn't have been too hard for them to fix it.
I didn't hate the story because of it or anything. It's just, you know, if it wasn't so easy to fact check it, I wouldn't be that bothered. You know, like 20 years ago, there was no internet. You know, it's like you would have had to go to the library and, you know, crack open a bunch of books or, you know, have a science background or something. But I mean, literally, it's like less than 5 minutes on Google and you could have had something that at least sounded relatively correct, you know, and that's what I find unfortunate with it.
Yeah.
Is that it didn't have to be that way.
No, I can see that, and it's a fair comment and stuff.
But I mean, other than that, I mean, you know, I kind of like look at it and say, yeah, you know, I think that as the series wraps up and as it goes more, I mean, it has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
I just hope, and I can't really tell from these two issues, that it gets a little bit more into the larger story and away from the formulaic, you know, planet and issue kind of thing. That's all.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you, because while I enjoy that kind of a thing, the fact that they're hinting at this bigger story, these other levels and other things going on, I want to get to that. To me, that sounds like you could really take this up a notch. But it's entertaining, and I like it. And like you said, it could have a lot more depth to it going forward.
Because even Star Trek, if you look at it, they didn't do every single episode on a planet. You know, sometimes they did stuff on the ship. Sometimes they'd go to a, you know, a Federation base, and you'd get background about the Federation and, you know, other different, you know, they kind of switched it up. So two issues in, maybe it's too early to call, but, you know, when they're both following kind of the same basic formula, well, I'm just a little afraid it's falling into a pattern. But it's maybe a not a fair judgment, you know, based on only two issues.
To me, whether they go to the planet or the adventures on the ship is irrelevant. I mean, a lot of the stuff on Deep Space Nine was your classic Star Trek kind of a story. It's just the people came to them versus them going to the people.
Right.
Not that big of a difference. And again, here, you know, they've got some potential. It's just a question of where they go with it. And a four-issue series is a really limited window to really explore that with. But fun stuff. I enjoyed it. Definitely looking forward to the second half of the miniseries.
Now, do you want to talk about Comic-Con? You're going to be up on stage at the podcasting panel on Thursday at 4 p.m., I believe it is, in room 9.
Yeah, that was pretty much exactly what I was going to say. I was going to tell people that the Friday episode might be a little later than usual because, I mean, I try to get this thing up to where it's bright and early, ready for people's iTunes or whatever podcatcher to download at the pre-dawn hour, but this panel, like you said, is going to be at 4 p.m. on Thursday. It's going to be in room 9 this year. That's a different room than last year. Room 9 is on the upper level. It's on the bay side, which is the water away from Harbor Drive, of the convention center. It's kind of across from room 6BCF, which is one of those, what used to be one of those big rooms, is now about the third or fourth largest room in the building, well behind Ballroom 20 and Hall H. But for old school Comic-Con attendees, what was one of the big rooms. So, I mean, I'm glad I noticed that. Otherwise, I would have just gone towards, you know, wherever it had been last year, and that probably wouldn't have worked too well because it's about a 10-minute walk between those two places. A little later in the evening, we're all going to be meeting at Rock Bottom Brewery around, would you say, 6:30 p.m. for dinner?
Yeah.
Everyone listening, if you're going to be at the San Diego Con, we would love to see you at the panel, talk with you before and after. Definitely, if you want to come to dinner, we would you know, enjoy that too. It's one of the few times I make it to a convention because I just don't travel all that much. And meeting people face-to-face is a lot of fun. I love hearing what you guys are thinking about comics, about what we're doing on the podcast, just the convention. I mean, the whole nine yards. So please try to hunt us down, and that's going to be one of the easiest times to do so. That episode with the actual panel will go up Friday, like I said. Just depends how fast I can get it edited and stuff. It may be late in the day or even in the evening or Saturday before it goes up. But if you can't make it to San Diego, we'll at least get you the podcasting panel.
Yeah. Now, otherwise, if you want to know where we'll be, and I don't know, John, if you've looked at this yet, but Comic-Con this year has got this schedule app on their site. And what I've done is I've gone through it, and I kind of looked at all the panels, and, you know, I don't know how much time you'll have to look at this, but it was kind of neat. You could pick all the panels that seem interesting to you, and it kind of prints out, allows you to print out, like, a, you know, personalized schedule. And I picked a bunch of panels, even ones that were kind of overlapping with each other. And this is just kind of a con tip anyway, because I think that, you know, sometimes you'll be down on the floor, and, you know, you'll maybe miss a panel, or you'll go to one panel and it's like, at least at San Diego, you know, it's booked, you know, it's totally full and you just can't get into it. So, you know, if you have a schedule and you know, oh, okay, well, there's this other one I was also interested in, you don't have to like dig out that, you know, the big book and try to be looking stuff up and things. But we have a thread on the forum that talks about, you know, where, what people are going to be doing, where they're interested and, you know, all that. So you can look on there.
Does that app allow you to sync up with your calendar program and stuff?
It does, I believe.
Okay, cool. In past years, what I've done is I've taken the panel listings, and I've started to do it this year. I just haven't had time to get it all the way through the process. But take the panel listings, kick that into Word, create a grid like they have put up this year, you know, in Excel, and then use that to generate iCalendar files that would allow you to work with, I believe, either Google Calendars or Outlook or, you know, standard. It's iCalendar is a standard meeting format and stuff. to where I could just go through that, load up my PDA or whatever I have. Now, granted, I'm on a smartphone now, so I'll probably see if I can set that up through Google Calendar or something.
Yeah, I just did the, print out a schedule one, prints out a nice little thing, and I'll just keep that as a handy reference with me.
I usually don't look through the panel listing until the drive out, and usually on the, because my sister and I drive out every year, and usually on that Saturday, well, we've got, nothing but desert in front of us, one of us will start going through of, hey, you might want to go to this. You've, talked about this or whatever. And that way we kind of mark up one with some highlighters.
Right.
One of us in yellow, the other in blue, and anything we're both planning on going to in green. So we've got a nice color coordinated thing. And, oh, that's where she's going to be or whatever. So.
Yeah, it's pretty handy to do, though, once you do that determination, if you just go on when you land, somewhere. It's just got little check boxes. Mm-hmm. So you can just go down and check all the ones that you're interested in. It's got all the days. And then once you're done, they're in, you create an account for yourself that you can actually hook up to your Facebook, for instance, account. And, kind of just has that information synced. And then you can do the little calendar. So
no, that's great they've done that. I've been suggesting that to them for years. Because, again, I've had on the website and stuff over the years, I think going back almost a decade or whatever, where I would have the grids and all that stuff just to where I could organize my day. Because going through the panel listings, it's so hard to figure out, well, if I go to this, what does it knock me out of? And once you've got it all kind of stacked, it's like, oh, this is 2 o'clock. I'm going to this, so I can't go to these 15 that start before and overlap, these 12 that go concurrently, and these 15 that start after and overlap, or however many there are. Definitely going into the convention prepared with what you're going to do, what you're going to want to buy, and stuff like that is just always a smart move. And we did an episode a year or two back on kind of getting ready for con. And that's something that I think is as relevant today as it was when we recorded it. So worth checking out if you're planning on going either to San Diego or to some other convention and just want some ideas on things to do to get ready for it.
Yep, absolutely.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that's it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Green Lantern number 67 from DC. All Winners Squad, Band of Heroes, number 2 from Marvel, and Executive Assistant Orchid, number 1 from Aspen Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.